it was the equating of Bush to Nixon that roused Chris Wallace of Fox News to stand up and say, the analogy between Nixon and George Bush is is not, to my sight, at all fair or appropriate. Richard Nixon's actions during, particularly during the cover-up of Watergate, were solely about himself, whereas George Bush was looking to, well, making mistakes, certainly, about in this way and that way, but he's basically looking to protect his country.
Wow.
And I forgot, I didn't read what Ron's...
Where is it? Where is it to be read? I guess I could go online, couldn't I, probably, and find
it?
Yeah.
It was initially report on... He was around. If you were to write Chris Matthews, Ron Howard, it would definitely come up.
You don't mean Chris Matthews, you mean Chris Wallace.
I meant to say Chris Wallace. Yeah. It came up Chris Matthews, because I was just reading about Chris Matthews in his Pennsylvania thing. Mm. Did you read about that? That he's thinking about running against Arlen?
No. They just keep bleeding over, don't they, into each other's worlds.
Yeah. Well, if you were there and Chris Wallace was taking issue with Ron, what would you say in front of to Mr. Wallace and to others?
I don't know. I would have to. I can't. I won't speculate because I wasn't there and I don't know exactly what it was Chris Wallace said. And they're certainly entirely different men.
Yeah.
In entirely different eras.
You know, it struck me one thing. You know, it's funny, kind of similar thoughts that Bill Clinton was letting go with and Richard Ed Nixon's funeral. They were fairly magnanimous and certainly charitable. But I don't think that George Bush will ever have the character to say, I let people down, I misled this country, I took us into war on fraudulent, utterly fraudulent purposes. Do you think that there's a...
Well, we have to remember that Richard Nixon said these things to David Frost several years later, after having not in any way admitted anything. Upon his resignation and his final days at the White House, understandably, the wounds were so enormous to him at the time. I still look at those tapes of him getting on that airplane, getting on that helicopter, and the look in his eyes, and, you know, getting up in the air and having a phone ring and someone say to you, you're no longer the president, somewhere over Idaho.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a line in the film that I asked to put in literally the day we were shooting, because it wasn't in the script. No one can know what it's like to resign the presidency. And it's true. None of us can possibly know what it's like, first of all, to be a president,
mm-hmm.
and second of all, to be this particular president who found himself about as vilified as any man could possibly be. And certainly in my lifetime, I suppose President Bush finds himself as about as unpopular in his own way as Richard Nixon was in his time.
Curiously though, not vilified, certainly by the press, he wasn't really raked over the coals that much.
No,
certainly disdained, but not the way Nixon was. There was real animal.
Yeah.
Right.
And After working on him as long as I did and watching him so much, I came to understand that vilification wasn't only for his actions, it was for his persona and his lack of any kind of smoothness, any kind of an ability to charm, even in the most offhanded way, the way a Truman could charm or an Eisenhower or a Roosevelt, or I mean all the presidents since I've been alive that I can remember looking at and watching. And I remember being a very, very young man standing on the corner somewhere in New York and seeing President Eisenhower go by in an open car in the days when presidents could do that, standing and waving at people on 42nd Street and thinking, that beaming smile and that don't you want him for your grandfather feeling you got from him. And Jimmy Carter in his own way had that kind of thing. Certainly John Kennedy had it. Richard Nixon didn't have it, and the combination of the events of Watergate and a persona they wanted to kick around anyway. But remember, he was elected with a huge mandate. That's the funny part. A year and a half before, he didn't squeak in. He had a presidency for 4 years that was very well accepted and approved by the people. And it's very funny about these things, because I was thinking about this in terms of my own life and other people's I know. Why is it so hard for people to say I made a mistake fairly quickly after the mistake? If Richard Nixon had been able, and again, we're not in his shoes, but if he'd been able to say, my people overstepped themselves, you know, this is after all a minor break-in, you know, no lives were lost here, there was no really major crime, and he would have, and if he'd gone and said, what is the fine? I will pay the fine. I will see that my, whoever the perpetrators are, which I didn't know about, serve their time for misdemeanor or whatever you want to call it. This would have gone away, and he would have had his second 4 years, and I think done some extraordinary things in terms of China foreign policy, this need he had to be a great statesman. All those things would have served him well. People would have gone on making fun of him and gone on vilifying him, but he might have, who knows, we don't know. He may have grown in our estimation in his second term. But that inability to say, I made a mistake, is what brought him down. And that need to cover it up. You know, like a kid does when I was little, my parents were out for lunch and I broke a candlestick and I ran around finding gum and stuff to stick the top on it, and it sat it on the table all teeter-tottery. And the minute my parents walked in, it went bloop, and I said, I didn't do that, you know. This need you have to cover up. Kids have that need.
You know, he's the old-style conservatives, the old-style, 70s-style, 60s-style conservatives, I started thinking this way after seeing that HBO doc by his granddaughter about Barry Goldwater, Mr. Conservative.
Yeah.
By today's standards of the neocons, he wasn't really all that intense in his conservatism. He was a relatively tolerable person philosophically.
Yeah, tolerant.
Intolerant.
Yeah.
I don't think that Richard Nixon is what I'm leading up to. I don't think he would have. I don't think he would have gone into Iraq. I think he was too much of a real politic. Shrewd game player to have, basically it was an emotional decision on, wouldn't you say?
I think, you know, I spent a year and a half with him, or maybe almost two years, and I'm still, not in that I live it, but when we talk about him and when all the movie stuff comes up again, I go back to his personality more than I do to his politics, because that's what I needed to find as the actor.
Right.
And I just found a man to be so deeply tormented and tortured, and it would be interesting to speculate what would have happened had he stayed president. Certainly after the Frost interviews, the next 20 years, all he did was try to resurrect himself, which is, by the way, what I came to believe was where Nixon was happiest. He was happiest climbing the ladder, you know, happiest fighting.
It goes for a lot of us, I
Yes,
think.
Fighting the big boys. Yeah. I'll get those big boys. I'll make them see me. He was happier there than being there, almost.
Right.
And maybe he unconsciously wanted to put himself back into a place where he could continue to fight for the recognition he felt he deserved.
Right.
Somebody told me a story among the thousands of stories I heard that years afterwards, I think even years after the Frost interviews, he decided he wanted to take a tour of one of the major cities, Paris or something. He wanted to go over and meet with an official or do something.
Okay.
And when he landed...
Kind of political tour, is what you're saying.
Something, yeah. It was long after his resignation and long after the Frost interviews.
Right.
And when he landed in the city, he was met by a hotel manager. That was the only official... The only official person they could rustle up to greet him at the airport was the manager of the hotel. No one in the political system, no one in the society. A hotel manager met him. Imagine what that must have felt like. After years of arriving and having the top folks waiting for you.
You should have taken the cue from David Frost and started to develop and find his Italian loafer self, you know, and say, well, I've done that, now I'll find the new, more effeminate side of myself. And
I don't think you can. I don't think people can. Certainly when you get up to that age, people, it's the rare person who's able to break those chains. They usually go to their death still choking on them. You know, did you read, what was her name? Was it Monica Crowley? Monica Crowley, who was his last assistant, a woman who stayed with him when he lived in here in, what was the town he lived in New
Saddle
Jersey?
Ridge or something?
Saddle River.
Or Saddle River, yeah.
Yeah, she wrote a very interesting book about his last years. You know, it still broke your heart. This was,
did she become a journalist after that? That
she is now, I think.
Yeah.
I think I've seen her on as a talking head somewhere.
Kind of pretty sharp.
Yes, very smart.
Like Peggy Noonan on that level. Yeah. You know, I really loved and missed, in one sense, the that Richard Nixon shambling, awkward physicality that you saw immediately when you walked out on stage in the very first moment of the play, which I saw after we spoke, which I thought was just great.
Thank you.
But the truth is that more of what's intended, more of Morgan's writing, not naturally, you had to, you know, tone it down and everything, but I just thought it was more affecting because it was, you know, it was, there's something about a stage performance. I don't know how to put this in the right words. I haven't seen your Thomas More, but it's just, I just thought Richard Nixon was better, quieter, and maybe because he knew him so well, it was easier to put these same things across. Am I in the...
Yes, you're in the right ballpark. I think it's better, too, and it was very difficult for me to watch the movie the first time, because you live with a character for such a long time, and Ron and I together found a darker Nixon, quieter Nixon, less theatrical Nixon. Much more internal, and since it's there for all time, it's nice to feel that we've captured something. I think one day I might, you know, years from now, I might go over to Lincoln Center and sit and watch the stage performance and maybe go, oh, well, I don't know, but you listen, you're required to do a lot on a stage. You just are. There's somebody many, many yards away from you who has to feel something. You can't play it in this tiny little way. You need to give it size and scope. And maybe those months of doing that, enabled me to be able to just live inside him much more deeply in front of a camera.
You didn't see Scofield do Thomas More back in the 60s, did you?
Yeah, I did. I was just in New York.
Was that in, 62?
61.
61. Because I never saw it or anything, but his film version is pretty contained, pretty quiet. I mean, there's the final speech before his accuser, which is great. That's obviously more pronounced.
But no, the role is, he plays in an extremely subdued way, very, very quietly. I don't in the play. I can't. The play is 2.5 hours long. It's much, much longer than the film. It has many more huge...
Oh, really? It's much longer than the film?
Much longer, yeah.
Sorry, I didn't mean to do that.
And it requires a kind of theatricality the movie didn't have.
Was he must have obviously been much more louder and theatrical himself back in, can you describe it a little bit?
I 1961 is a long time ago. I'm trying to remember. I certainly remember enjoying it, but remember, he was also a lot younger than I am when he played it. He was 39 or 40.
Mm.
He was in that age range when he played it. I'm a hell of a lot older than Thomas More was. I think Thomas More was I'm not sure how old he was when he finally went, 66 or something. Yeah.
He was that age when that
when
event
he died.
Was happening?
I think he was that age when he died.
Did you ever find yourself differing? I mean, I know that Ron saw it out of being falling in love with your work when he first saw it in London, but did you guys ever differ about any matters of tone or emphasis?
No.
Was there any kind of...
Oddly enough, no. Mm. I one of the greatest gifts Ron gave us was his curiosity. His desire to ask questions on a daily basis in the brief rehearsal period we had. And he came to New York while we were performing it, and we sat alone, he and I, as he did with Michael, for hours just going through the moment by moment by moment, and he asked and asked and asked. He didn't say, here's how I see it. He just said, what is your Nixon? Tell me about him, where? And then when we were on the set, he said, remember we talked that, I think you want to bring more of that, you want to do a little bit of this. He was a wonderful, he's exactly what you would want a director to be. Right there, in your ear, supportive, constantly urging you to do the best. And then when he gets something he really loves, then just saying, why don't we just tweak it a little here, tweak a little there. You felt very safe. He has a language because he's an actor. Clooney is the same way. I loved Good Night and Good Luck because Clooney is an actor, and he knows how fragile an actor is. He knows you can say a phrase that can turn an actor off. Not turn him off this way, but emotionally shut him down. Mm. Because when you're in front of a camera, and no one knows what it's like unless you're one of the people in front, you know, there can be a guy literally with a microphone standing next to you, and he can feel the heat of the light, but he has no idea what it's like to be there. And if you suddenly turned that camera on the guy with the mic, he'd change a little because the camera would be on him. And the whole job of being an actor is, when that camera swings around to you like that, not to change. You know, and it's hard to do. So when you have a director who has been there and knows how easily you can be damaged, and speaks a language that encourages you, it's really wonderful.
You haven't ever worked with a director along the line. I'll take two examples, David Fincher, Stanley Kubrick, you know, 20, 30 takes. Just trying
yes,
to
oh, many.
Really?
Ron is.
Many.
Ron is, on average, 20 to 25 takes. Adrian Lyne is 30 to 40 takes. I would say that Roman Polanski's 15 to 20 takes. Ivan Reitman does a lot of takes. Yeah. George Clooney does maximum three.
Really?
Yeah, maximum three.
Like
all
Clint
my
Eastwood,
all of my work in Good Night and Good Luck is the second take, maybe second or third take.
You're a fast warmer. You're there early.
I'm a director's boy. I suss out my director and figure out, because it's his medium. He's got the scissor, he's got the time, and he's going to put it together. So if I know that he wants to get it in two or three takes, I'm ready for him. And unless I feel I've gone off, incredibly off, I don't ask for any more. And if someone wants as many takes as Ron does, I know I have to be on a dime every time. You know, it's your job. It's just your job. You got to figure him out. I don't think I asked ever to do it again when we did Good Night and Good Luck, because I was very comfortable with the way George set it up. And I certainly didn't ask Ron if I could do it again, because I felt, okay. You know, out of those 20-some-odd times, he's bound to have found what he wants.
Did you happen to see the Obama ad that he did?
Yes, yes.
It was pretty clever.
Yes, it was very clever, really clever.
Nicely shot, personable actor, funny.
Yeah, funny.
and yet I was in the same story about Chris Wallace taking issue with Ron. It he had mentioned in the story that Ron had voted for Nixon back in 68 or 72. I'm not sure which year.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Usually you start out radical and then you become a little more.
Yeah.
And I don't know what he was doing back in 72.
No, that's funny. I didn't know that. And how old was he in 72? He was in
fairly
his 20s.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's funny.
You know who else voted for Richard Nixon in 72?
Who?
Sonny and Cher.
Really?
Back when they had their hit show and everything.
Yeah.
Hippie garb, beads, I got you, babe.
I wonder if I wonder if Sammy Davis did this, that famous photograph that people vilified Sammy for,
you know,
of hugging the president. It's extraordinary about those single images, isn't it? It's just an image where they were both laughing and he just did that.
Mm-hmm.
And then for years and years and years, people used it against him. A split second.
Yeah.
So you wonder why you watch politicians being so constantly aware when they're out publicly of every moment, every smile, because they know there's somebody shuddering away 50, 60, 70, 80 times in a couple of minutes, waiting for the slip or the gaffe or the drool or the you know, making some gruesome face, and that picture then becomes... Wasn't there a picture of Nixon that was constantly used in Esquire year after year?
Yeah. Why is this man laughing?
Yeah, right? Why is this man laughing? Yeah.
You know, that quote that you gave USA Today the other day, the solitude of goodness or virtue,
yes,
and then the solitude of evil. And yet, right away, my mind thought, well, is Richard Nixon really evil? Because, again, you were talking about you wanted to get at him personally, not so much politically. And when I think of Richard Nixon, I always think, first and foremost, good dog Richard, he and his mother, the little poor boy in Whittier.
Yeah.
Really rough time, and you know, the girls didn't like him and all that, and all his initial hang-ups. I just never have seen him as an evil figure, but extremely tragic.
I didn't mean it in relationship to him being evil and Sir Thomas More being good, but listen, you can't take any one person and label them any one thing. If you look at what Richard Nixon did to Alger Hiss, if you look what he did to Helen Gehagen Douglas, you could probably use the word evil. If you look at his foreign policy and how he performed in China and what his statesmanlike desires were, you could use the word noble.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's a mass of different contradictory things, and we just need to rubber stamp somebody. You know, I'm sure there are people who are going to come away from Frost Nixon feeling I'm too sympathetic. But
hey, isn't the original a culling of the original 70 whatever hours between Frost and Nixon just out on DVD? Didn't that just
The Nixon Library just put something out 2 days ago. I don't know what it is, but they just released millions and millions or thousands and thousands of pages of something.
Yes, I read
private papers.
Right, lots of tapes.
And I'm sure it's not a coincidence that they did it just around the time the movie's out. There'll be a lot of interesting talk about Nixon over the next couple of months.
Anyway, in any case, on YouTube, I think it was, I found the clip of him inquiring about, in which the line elicited, well, when the president does it, it's not illegal. And Frost's response is to, so you're saying, you know, without any noticeable alarm, whereas in not the movie, but you know, the trailers tend to overemphasize. They have one of the guys in the back, I don't know if it's Sam Rockwell or whatever, somebody going, my God, did he say that?
Yeah.
And Sheen going, excuse me, you know.
Yes.
I just hate that, because they didn't say that. Everybody always covers up. Those big things are not necessarily dramatic when they are said, but they certainly do sound that way.
But then you're making a movie. You're making a film.
Yeah. Does somebody go, my God, or excuse me, or something?
I can't remember the actual, but now you're intriguing me because I have them all. So I'll go back and see what David's reaction was when Nixon said, I'm saying when the president does, it's not illegal.
Yeah.
But you see, knowing how wily David was, one of the great weapons any interviewer has is his enigmaticness, and his inside he may be thinking, I remember once we were rehearsing that confession scene way back early in the early days when we were rehearsing it, and I played that whole I've Let My Country Down scene, and I was looking at Michael, and the director was walking around, we were talking about it, the director said to Michael, "What's on your mind when Nixon makes that confession?" And Michael said, "Oh, I'm thinking I'm a star." Because he was thinking from his point of view.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure it's it's the downstairs.
I'll
open it.
Hello.
So, how much longer are you doing A Man for All Seasons?
Sunday.
This coming Sunday?
Yeah, week from Sunday. One more week.
Oh.
We close. We have to get ready, don't we? Yeah. We're almost done.
Okay.
Sunday, yeah.
What happens during the last few days? Do you find new surges of energy coming to you? And you think, oh my goodness, I don't have to do the long run any longer. Here it comes.
Do you remember what you were like when you watched this clock and it got to be 2:45 and the bell rang?
That's cool.
And your new school was
mm-hmm.
out? It's like that. Here comes recess.
You got a film lineup? Anything happening as a result of all this adulation and Oscar talk?
No, I have a wonderful, blessed time off. I'm really happy. It's been a wonderful period of work, and now I'm going to take my time. Something will come up. I never worry about that.
Right.
It's nice to see you again.
Nice to see you again.
Yeah, it was a year, wasn't it?
At least whenever, was that?
That remains close to my favorite film.
Yeah.
I think it's a beautiful picture.
Yeah.
Starting out. Thanks to see you.